Chapter 15. On Sunday morning, Eve woke early after a restless night of odd, unremembered dreams. She'd surfaced from sleep at intervals, her heart racing, her limbs rigid, only to drift back into the nightmare. At 7, she got up, stood by the window, and looked out at the farmyard and the hills beyond. There were the sounds of birdsong and distant sheep, the background noises of her life since she'd moved here. She picked up her phone and saw a list of missed calls and new emails. Friends asking after her, offering hospitality, condolence, wanting a chance to be a part of the drama. She felt swamped by the attention. What she really needed was a day in the studio to lose herself in the rhythm of glassmaking, the constant movement of twisting the pipe, the concentration needed in heating, melting and blowing would fill her mind and let her escape, at least for a while. She had the sense that today she might create something fine, a pleasing shape, an eruption of colour, something entirely unique. But the studio was still a crime scene with a police officer standing outside it, looking bored. She made coffee and thought she should take a mug down to him. In the end, though, a kind of lethargy took over, and even walking down the stairs and through the big, cool kitchen seemed far too much effort. She looked at her phone again and scanned through the messages. There was one from a woman called Lauren Miller, a colleague of her father's, asking if they might meet. No way. That was the last thing she needed, someone else wanting a part in the drama of her father's death. Eve poured more coffee and returned to her seat by the window. John Grieve was releasing the cows from the parlour. She watched him walking them back down the lane to their field by the common. Sometime later, Sarah Grieve came out of the cottage. She was wearing green overalls, so she looked like a gooseberry, round and plump, juicy. From this angle, her head seemed very small, like a gooseberry's stalk. Sarah looked up at her, waved, and made a gesture to suggest that Eve was being invited into the cottage for a drink or something to eat. Eve shook her head. She knew then that she had to get away from Westercombe for the day. What could be worse than sitting in the flat while the police officers and crime scene investigators, in their nightmare white suits and masks, pulled apart her studio and her father's life. She switched on her phone and sent a text to Sarah. Need to get out for a while. Sure you understand. Don't worry. If anyone asks, I'll be back at tea time. She was pleased with tea time. It was flexible and could mean anything from late afternoon to well into the evening. Sarah's husband John called dinner tea. She switched the phone off again. She was tempted to leave it in the flat, but at the last minute she picked it up. How dependent everyone had become on these devices. Even in the midst of this crisis, she couldn't imagine leaving home without it. Her car was in the yard, and a different police officer on the gate stopped her as she pulled out. This was a woman with a round baby face and short blonde hair.
"Hi, I'm Sharon, just here to keep an eye out for all of you."
A pause.
"Have you let D.I. Venn know where you're off to?"
Her voice was kind enough, but the question rankled. "I don't think I'm under house arrest." The comment shocked Eve. It was as if someone else had spoken, and she felt her hands gripping tighter on the steering wheel. She wondered if she should have taken up Jonathan's invitation and moved in with him for a while. But that would have meant living with the detective who was investigating her father's death, and how weird would that feel?
"Of course not. He'll just want to make sure you're okay. He's a bit of a mother hen, our Inspector Venn."
"And you're talking to me as if I were an 8-year-old. But the words remained unsaid. Eve had never been good at confrontation, and today she was too exhausted to make a fuss.
"Sorry if I was rude, I just need to be away. You'll appreciate that, and I've got my phone with me if anyone needs to get in touch." "Of course, my love, just take it easy, okay?"
The officer gave her a little wave and sent her on her way. Eve drove. The car, a Mini, felt like a place of safety. Her parents had given it to her when she'd graduated. Her dad had offered to replace it with something a bit newer a year ago, but she'd said she'd keep it, maybe wait to replace it until the electric model came out, do what she could to save the planet. She had no direction in mind. When she hit the main road near Instow, she headed towards Biddeford, the town on the River Torridge, and then out towards the coast. She parked up at Northern Burrows, put a random amount of cash into the pay and display machine and walked along the top of the pebble bank, which separated the estuary from the golf course. The sun was behind her as she looked across the two rivers to Crow Point.
It was still too early for the horde of tourists to descend on the beach, but there were dog walkers and families hoping to find a good spot before the crowds arrived. Then she picked up the car and went inland, down narrow lanes with tall overgrown hedges and grass growing in the middle of the road, not caring that she was lost. Being lost was good, the equivalent of escaping into making glass. It stopped her from thinking. Eventually she felt hungry, came to a junction and followed the sign to South Moulton. She got the last parking space close to the cattle market and felt ridiculously pleased with herself. The town was Sunday relaxed. It was early afternoon, the pubs and cafes busy with people taking a late lunch. She found a table in a coffee shop with low beams and ordered tea and sandwiches, revelled in the anonymity, the fact that nobody was asking how she was, that there were ordinary conversations going on all around her. There was a moment of stabbing guilt then, like the shard of glass in her father's neck. How could she feel this content when he had so recently died? She began to cry, pretending to the waitress who brought the bill that she was suffering from hay fever, and went out into the street. She drove on, up towards Exmoor in search of a breeze, and only stopped when she came to a place close to a river, shaded by trees. There was a fisherman on the opposite bank, but he took no notice of her. That was when she switched on her phone. Habit, the curse of her generation, needing always to be in touch with the world. There were texts from the same friends who'd been in contact the night before. She ignored them. Today she had the right not to care about them. Grief gave her that freedom, the permission to do as she pleased for one day at least. Then a text from Wesley, which seemed strangely formal, quite unlike him. She was never entirely sure what she made of Wes. Sometimes he seemed like an eccentric older brother, wild and unreliable, but keeping a lookout for her all the same. Sometimes he just irritated her with his lack of responsibility and focus. How could he still live like this? He must be at least 40, 45 even. He would make a fine musician or a good artist, if only he worked a bit harder at either craft. The message said, "I'd like to talk to you if you're free. It's urgent. I'll be in my shed at the woodyard, 4:30. It was 3:30, plenty of time to make it into Barnstable if she decided to go. Wesley had his studio in Westercombe, but his work was made with found objects, mostly material scavenged from skips, pallets, and large pieces of driftwood. He made furniture from them as well as art, twisty garden benches, coat racks, coffee tables fashioned from discarded bedroom doors. There was no room to store all his scavenging in his studio, which was the same size as hers, so he'd conned a space at the woodyard, a large, unused shed at the back of the building. The deal was that he was supposed to give the occasional workshop in lieu of rent, but that seemed to have been forgotten after the first couple of sessions. If it had been one of Wesley's usual texts, all misspellings and random emojis, she might have deleted it with all the others. But here, he seemed so serious and the meeting sounded important to him. Besides, she'd driven aimlessly for long enough. The woodyard was somewhere to aim for, and it would put off the moment when she had to go home. Maybe she'd be able to meet up with Jonathan, too. She'd always thought of him as a much older brother, or a kind younger uncle. But now she seemed to be clinging to the thought of him as if he were a substitute dad. She sent a text back to Wesley. Okay. Chapter 16. Matthew left Lauren Miller's house in Appledore and drove back to Barnstable. Dorothy Venn was waiting for him at her home. Matthew could see her peering through the window of the bungalow where he'd grown up as a child. It had always felt like an old person's house, even when his parents had been in early middle age. It was as if his mother, at least, had always been anxious, always planning for some disaster, which had never occurred until her son, her only beloved child, had renounced his faith publicly at a meeting of the Brethren and brought shame upon the whole family. It had been a murder which had brought them together again, a body on a beach and the kidnapping of a woman with a learning disability. Matthew supposed he should be grateful for the resulting awkward reconciliation, but sometimes he thought life had been easier when there'd been no contact. Contact brought responsibility, and he could see now in the gaunt, sharp face looking out at him that his mother was getting old. He was the only son and the only person who would care for her. There was no sign of weakness, however, when she opened the door. I thought you were going to be late. It was 5 minutes earlier than they'd arranged, but he said nothing. He opened the car door for her and helped her in. Happy birthday. It's only another day, nothing to make a fuss about.
Have you been to the meeting?
He meant the meeting of the Barham Brethren, held in a dusty community hall on the edge of the town. He remembered the smell of rising damp, disinfectant and elderly women.
Of course.
Brother Anthony gave me a lift and brought me home. Of course. The Brethren might have been riven by scandal and corruption, but she'd chosen to maintain her loyalty. Matthew could understand that. It had been hard enough for him to break away as a young man, and the community was all that his mother had known. Like him, she'd been born into it. They drove the rest of the way in silence. She sat with her handbag on her lap, her knees firmly together. She was still in the clothes she would have worn to the meeting. A green skirt and a long-sleeved white blouse. Despite the heat, she had on a green hand-knitted cardigan. She had removed the hat, something woolen and mushroom-shaped, which seemed to be required dress code at Brethren worship. She spoke first.
Where exactly do you live?
In the house close to the shore at Crow Point. Do you remember? We had picnics on the beach there sometimes. She nodded and for the first time gave a little smile.
Your father loved a picnic.
A pause.
I could never see the point. Sand gets everywhere. But he loved the open air.
You must miss him a lot.
For a while, Matthew thought he'd overstepped some virtual mark, become too personal, but at last she answered.
I do. All the time. If it weren't for the brothers and sisters, I think the loneliness would kill me.
The comment took his breath away, and a wave of guilt swept over him. He'd thought his mother had stuck with the Brethren out of stubbornness, or because her faith had remained despite the drama surrounding it earlier in the year. But of course, these people were her friends. They had been there for her when her husband died and when Matthew had stayed away. They came to the traffic lights in the centre of Braunton. There was already a queue of cars leading to the coast, and the lights changed twice before they could get through. A group of bronzed, scantily dressed young women crossed the road in front of them, and he sensed his mother's disapproval, but she didn't speak. They crawled along the road until the turnoff by the Great Marsh. This was a place for locals. Most holidaymakers didn't realise that it was a way to the beach, to the other end of the long sweep of Saunton Sands. Matthew threw change into the basket at the tollkeeper's cottage, the gate lifted and he drove through. He pulled into their drive and switched off the engine.
This would be a bleak sort of place in a gale, his mother said.
He opened the car door for her and offered her a hand to get out. She stood for a moment looking around her.
You've made a lovely garden, though.
That's Jonathan's work, Matthew said. He's the practical, creative one. Again, she took a while to answer.
I don't know about that. You were always creative when you were a boy.
Matthew smiled. The words felt like a vindication of himself as a boy and of the relationship with his husband. Perhaps, after all, this would work out. Come on in. You'll see he's a brilliant cook, too. She sniffed.
No need to have gone to any trouble.
Jonathan had heard the car and was at the door to meet them, arms wide in greeting.
Come in, and happy birthday, Mrs. Venn.
He gave Matthew a light kiss on the cheek. His mother pretended not to notice and was looking round the kitchen.
This is very fancy.
We love it, Jonathan said. The table was laid and there were two vases filled with deep red roses from the garden. The window was wide open and the curtains stirred in the breeze. It was as close to eating outside as Jonathan could make it. Jonathan took off his apron and hung it on the back of the cupboard door. He was wearing black shorts and a black t-shirt with the name of a craft brewery on the front. Dorothy wouldn't recognize the name. On his feet he wore flip-flops. His toes were wide and flat. Matthew called them hobbit's feet. A silliness and intimacy he'd allowed himself with no other person. His mother stared at Jonathan for a moment, as curious as if he were a being from another planet.
Are you ready to eat?
Jonathan asked.
Or would you like a tour of the house first?
Why don't we have lunch now? Matthew couldn't bear the idea of showing his mother around the house,
another bedroom with two dressing gowns, and another bathroom with two toothbrushes. And Jonathan wasn't the tidiest person. Who knew what might be left out? Matthew wanted to check first. I might be called back to work. We're in the middle of a murder investigation.
That makes sense. Jonathan rolled his eyes at the mention of work, but only Matthew could see. And of course, I have champagne.
Dorothy still hadn't spoken. The room with its flowers, the copper pans hanging from a rack on the ceiling, and the art on the wall, mostly posters for exhibitions Jonathan had held at the woodyard, seemed to overwhelm her with its space and its colour. She appeared almost breathless. Jonathan went to the fridge and pulled out a bottle. Only the supermarket brand, but real champagne all the same.
Let's have this with a starter.
Matthew expected his mother to refuse. Alcohol wasn't forbidden by the brethren, and his father had enjoyed a whiskey most evenings after work, but Dorothy never participated. More, Matthew suspected, because she enjoyed the martyrdom of denying herself pleasure than through religious conviction. Now she stood in the middle of the room, gripping her handbag, looking around her, and he saw that she was nervous. He'd never known his mother to be anything other than confident in her certainty.
There's orange juice if you prefer,
Jonathan said very gently. She might have been one of his clients at the Woodyard Day Centre.
It's your day. Whatever makes you happy. Why don't you sit here with your back to the window, then you're not squinting into the sun?
He took her arm and led her to the head of the table. Matthew watched, moved as she took her seat. She smiled. At Jonathan, not at him.
I might try a glass of champagne, she said. I had some at a wedding for the toasts, and I did quite enjoy it.
Jonathan turned, winked at Matthew, and opened the bottle. The phone call came late in the afternoon. Dorothy had complimented Jonathan on the tenderness of the beef, the way the Yorkshire puddings had risen.
I was never very good at batter, not for Yorkshire puddings or pancakes.
The cake, with its candles and elaborate decoration, had been a huge success. After a lifetime of healthy eating, it seemed to Matthew that his mother actually had a very sweet tooth, and she had been persuaded to have a second slice. He and Jonathan had sung Happy Birthday, Jonathan taking the lead. The whole afternoon had a strange, surreal tinge to it. It was hard for Matthew to believe that this woman, who had haunted his life and had been the subject of earnest discussions with his therapist, had become elderly, lonely, and powerless. Someone who was willing to compromise in return for kindness and company. By now she was rather pink and had removed the cardigan. Her handbag had been put under her chair. She looked younger, more relaxed than Matthew could remember. Jonathan had been collecting plates. There were two empty coffee cups on the table. Dorothy had asked for tea, and Jonathan had made it for her in a small pot. She'd liked that. She still disapproved of tea bags. Matthew had switched off his phone, but he could hear it vibrating in his pocket. He looked at it. Sorry, I really have to take this. He walked out into the garden and heard gulls, the tug of the tide on the shore.
Boss.
It was Jen Rafferty calling on his mobile.
I'm sorry to disturb you. I know you were busy today.
What is it?
I think you need to come in. There's just been a 999 call. The report of another body.
Chapter 17. Eve had taken her time driving back to Barnstable. When she arrived at the huge converted sawmill on the River Tor, which had become the Woodyard Arts Centre, the place was almost empty. The day centre for adults with learning disabilities was closed at the weekend, and there were no classes on a Sunday, no Pilates or community choir, no middle-aged women learning to paint with watercolours. The cafe opened to serve Sunday lunches, but soon that would be closing too. In the quiet of a hot late afternoon, she imagined the timber yard as it had once been, the workers and the machinery overpowering with its noise. Today, the silence sang out. There was a marked car park at the front for the centre's visitors, but she made her way through the big open wooden gates to the back, to the rough concrete yard where the staff left their vehicles. This was close to where Wesley stored his found and scavenged material. Wesley's shed was as large as a good-sized barn, built from wood but solid. He had once held a party there, after hours, and Jonathan had gone ape.
Someone must have told him it was happening, and the centre manager had turned up, genuinely furious, yelling about Wesley taking the piss. "We're not insured for this kind of thing. Someone gets hurt or you start a fire and we're fucked. Not just me, but my day centre clients, and the women who sing in the choir, and the artists who are supposed to be your mates. Just fucking grow up, Wesley." Yet Wesley was still here, still using the place. Eve thought he slid through life on charm and the goodwill of others. He was amiable, good to be around. He lightened the mood wherever he went, so they all put up with him. The shed had double doors, wide enough to let a forklift in. Wesley usually left them open if he was inside, but today they were closed. Not locked, though. The padlock had been left on the hook. She slid the doors open. The windows were small and high in the walls, too dusty, smeared with decades of grime and countless spiders' webs to let in much light. "Wes?" It would be typical of him to summon her here and then to be late. But he must be here, otherwise the doors would still be padlocked, and besides, she had noticed his white van parked in a corner away from the sun. She walked further into the space and her eyes got used to the gloom. One of the windows had a clear patch in the middle, and the sun shone through it like a spotlight. There was a pile of pallets, roughly stacked at one end. Wes used them a lot in his art. He painted on them, produced shop signs and quirky notices to go into restaurants and bars, frames for menu blackboards, presents for friends. He'd made a painting for her of a vase that had been selected for an exhibition at the V&A, with the date. It hung now in her flat. Perhaps, after all, it was those moments of kindness that forced them to tolerate the fact that he used them. This was more than a storeroom. He made his larger furniture here, and there was a workbench in the centre of the space. She could see the man now, and moved slowly towards him, frightened already of what she might find. Because Wes wasn't a quiet man. He'd have responded to her shout, jumped to his feet, called out a greeting in return, put his arms around her. And she was scared, because she still had an image of her father, lying on her studio floor in a pool of blood. There was blood here, too, and a shard of glass, her glass, not green this time, but blue, was sticking in his neck. A blue vase had been shattered here. She remembered making it and giving it to Frank Lay as a present. And there were pieces of glass scattered across the bench, reflecting the single beam of the sun. Blood had spattered across the bench at as far as the nearest wall. She pulled her gaze back to the pieces of glass, which looked almost decorative in the shaft of sunlight, and wondered how they had got here. Anything rather than to look at Wesley, who was still and white, stark against the red pool of blood, already dried and dark in the heat, and was deciding she should phone 999 when there was a sound outside, the screaming of sirens and the thumping of boots, loud and rhythmic as soldiers' drums on the uneven concrete, and half a dozen police officers ran in through the doors, yelling for her to get on her knees and put her hands on her head. Chapter 18. When Matthew Venn arrived at the scene, Jen Rafferty was already there. He'd left Jonathan to get his mother home in a taxi. "You can't drive," Matthew had said. "You'll be over the limit." Always the cop, but then Jonathan had finished most of the bottle of fizz. Jonathan had nodded, was already calling the local minicab when Matthew left. "After we've dropped her off, I'll come on to the woodyard. I'll see you there." Matthew's mother had been confused by the change in mood, the sudden rush to action. There'd never been much drama in her life. Not that she'd been aware of, at least, until the kidnapping of her friend's learning disabled daughter, and she'd seen little of that investigation. Before that, even his father's death had been expected and managed, a slipping away, not a sudden event. But when Matthew had hurried away, she'd created no fuss. There was no recrimination that the birthday celebration was being cut short. In old age, she was making fewer demands. Loneliness had changed her. Matthew was confused too. He'd received garbled stories about the 999 call and the discovery of the body. Initially, it seemed that the first officers at the scene had assumed they had the perpetrator. A woman crouched over the body, a piece of glass in her hand, blood on her clothes. But the glass in the woman's hand hadn't been the murder weapon. That was still in the victim's neck. And this was Eve Yeo, who had just lost her father. Matthew couldn't see her as a serial killer. The idea was ludicrous. When he arrived at the woodyard, Jen got out of her car to talk to him. Matthew thought she looked drained and white. This had hit her personally. He wondered if she'd had a closer relationship with the victim than she'd let on. "No way could it have been Eve," Jen said. "The caretaker saw her drive in at 4:20. The 999 call was made 10 minutes before that. Kerno had been dead for a while before she got here." Matthew saw now that Eve was sitting in the passenger seat of Jen's car. She was frozen, her face too drained of colour. Was this another woman who'd been taken in by Kerno's charm? He considered the logic behind Jen's statement. "I suppose she could have made the call before coming to kill him, but I agree that it's unlikely." He paused. "Was the call made by a man or a woman?" "You can hear the recording. Hard to tell, apparently. The voice is muffled, disguised. We'll need to get it analysed." Matthew nodded towards the car. The glassmaker was as still as stone, staring ahead of her. "What did you get from Eve?" "Not much. She's still in shock." "I'll take her home and we can chat again there. Asked if she'd prefer to go back to her dad's house now the CSIs have finished there. But she said she'd rather be at the farm. The house in Barnstable has too many memories. That's about her mother, I guess." Matthew nodded. He looked at the group of uniformed officers standing close to the main building of the woodyard. Ross May was with them. "I suppose our eager young DC led the charge."
"Yeah," said Jen. "You can't blame him, though. I was in the office when we got the shout from emergency services. You get a call, apparently from a witness, saying that someone related to the Westerham murder has been attacked. You don't hang about. The guy could still be alive. The attacker could still be at the scene."
Matthew didn't respond immediately. "You could hang about long enough to consult the officer in charge of the case." But then Matthew had said he shouldn't be disturbed unless it was urgent. His team, his responsibility. "Did he talk to you before gathering the troops and setting out?" Jen gave a quick grin. "Yes, but he took charge on the ground. I stayed behind for a moment to call for backup and to phone you." Matthew nodded to show that she, at least, had got it right. "Did Eve tell you how she came to be here?"
"She got a text, apparently from Wesley, asking her to meet him here, but his phone's not on his body."
"So someone set her up. The killer sent her the message using Wesley's phone.
Looks like it."
Matthew was suddenly furious. These changes of mood hit him sometimes, scaring him with their ferocity. Not a red mist, but a clear flash of white light, a lack of control, a rush of energy and aggression. Calling Eve to the murder scene seemed willful, almost playful. The killer must have known that the police would check the voice on the 999 call and the timing of the text. This wasn't setting the woman up as a realistic suspect. It was cruel. A child pulling the wings off a living fly. Matthew took time to breathe slowly, counting the seconds, trying to release the tension in his body. "Did the caretaker see anyone else in the yard this afternoon?"
Jen shook her head.
"No, he had the afternoon off and only came back to check the place was empty before locking the main gates into the centre car park. This yard is always left open in case staff want to use the place after hours." A pause. "There'll be CCTV, though."
"Maybe."
Matthew wasn't so sure. Jonathan was running the place on a shoestring. He'd maintain the security in the main building and the areas surrounding the day centre, but perhaps not here. He was about to pull on his scene suit, then thought he should give Eve some reassurance. And the last thing she'd need was some anonymous figure in a hood and mask. The suits made his kindest officers look sinister. He opened the car door and sat beside her, perched sideways, his feet still on the cracked concrete, not wanting to crowd her.
"I'm so sorry," he said, "that you had to go through this again. I can't imagine what it must be like."
Eve turned to face him.
"It doesn't hurt yet.
It's unreal. As if I've wandered onto a film set."
"Of course. One shock too many. We'll need to hang on to your car just for the moment, but we'll get it back to you as soon as we can. It's just routine. Nothing to worry about."
"The blue glass vase? The one that was in there?"
Eve made a vague gesture with her hand, but couldn't look at the shed. It was one of mine. I gave it to Frank Lay as a birthday present. He'd filled it with flowers on the evening we spent with him, the night before I found my father in the studio.
Are you sure?
Oh, yes. She sounded offended. They're all slightly different, my pieces. Individual. I can recognize each one.
Brian Branscombe, the crime scene manager, walked Matthew round the locus. He was middle-aged, diffident, unwilling to commit himself without reason, meticulous. He had a reputation for being slow, but Matthew would rather have slow than impulsive. They stood for a moment at the wide sliding door into the shed and looked in. The pathologist hadn't yet arrived, and Wesley's body still lay in the middle of the space next to the workbench. Shattered blue glass glinted in the shaft of sunlight. The room could have been a piece of installation art.
So we assume he was killed here.
Oh, I think so.
Branscombe was local, the accent somehow comforting.
All that blood.
It looks staged somehow. More staged than the Westercombe stabbing.
Maybe they had more time.
Branscombe stepped through the doors and stood next to the wall. A CSI was moving through the space, a fingerprint powder brush in his hand. Matthew assumed it was a man, but it was hard to tell. More would turn up soon, but this was a Sunday. The county was big and the team was small.
I don't think I've heard back from you.
Matthew thought he should be used to wearing the mask by now, but it felt uncomfortable, and the scene suit seemed to trap the heat and made him feel unbearably hot.
Did you get any workable fingerprints from the green glass, the piece used to kill Yo?
Only a smudge which came from the daughter.
Branscombe moved closer to the body.
And you'd expect that. She made the thing.
He sounded distracted. All his attention now was on this locus.
I think our victim was standing here, at the bench. Look, he's wearing headphones, so he was probably listening to music. He might not have heard the killer approaching.
Not until it was too late, at least.
But he'd have heard if the perpetrator smashed the vase on the bench, and seen what was happening too. Matthew was trying to picture the scene. Wesley had been focused on his work. There was a plank of timber, which could have been part of an old roof joist, lying across the bench and held by a vise. A handsaw lying on the floor looked as if it had fallen out of his hand when he was killed. In headphones, he might not have heard the attacker approaching. But the shattered vase was in his line of sight.
The vase could have been prepared in advance, Branscombe said. Smashed elsewhere and brought in pieces. One used for the stabbing and the rest left here for effect.
And to point us back to Westercombe.
Wesley would have been listening to music on his phone. Now Matthew was talking to himself. And we haven't found that.
There's a chance of DNA. In this weather, our killer could have been sweating. Even if he was wearing gloves, droplets might have fallen from his forehead onto the surface of the glass.
If it's there, I know you'll find it.
This wasn't flattery. There was no need for Branscombe to answer. He knew how good he was at this. Matthew went on, putting his first thoughts into words. I have a sense of someone overconfident, willing to take risks. The general public don't come to this part of the woodyard. But he could have been disturbed at any time. The killer might not have been so cautious or careful this time.
Let's hope.
If your theory works, Matthew said, and the killer came up behind Wesley and surprised him, we're looking for someone who's right-handed, aren't we?
Yep.
Branscombe was definite now.
They must have been.
Thanks. I'll leave you to it. You'll give me a shout if there's anything important. Branscombe remained silent as if the answer was too obvious to be worth speaking. Outside, there was a slight movement of air, but still it was hotter than they were used to. Matthew stripped off the scene suit. A taxi pulled up in the road outside, and Jonathan was there, dressed as he had been at the lunch, in shorts and t-shirt, flip-flops on his feet. For a moment, Matthew wondered what that must be like, to dress for comfort, to be so loose and easy. But he felt more comfortable in a shirt and tie, real shoes, highly polished. His clothes gave him confidence, support. He went over to Jonathan, partly to stop him wandering into the area, which still hadn't been completely taped,
partly because his husband's presence was always calming, a reassurance that in the end all would be well.
I got your mother home okay?
Thanks. He paused for a beat. And thanks for looking after her so well and making her feel special.
Jonathan shrugged. It's easy, isn't it, when you're not too close? You're better around my parents than I am.
He nodded towards the activity, the officers in their white zombie suits.
Who is it?
Wesley Curnow. Matthew waited for a reaction, but there was none. Of course, you'll have known him if he rented the shed from you.
We never saw much in the way of rent.
Matthew was surprised by the coldness of the response. This was Jonathan, who had sympathy for losers, drifters, and dropouts of every kind.
You didn't like him? Perhaps I liked him too much and that was the problem. Should have turfed him out ages ago.
Jonathan paused.
I knew he was taking the piss. He used people, but somehow they didn't mind. He was like a spoiled kid, desperate to be loved. Charming, but in the end, entirely selfish.
Matthew didn't say anything. He knew his husband well enough to realise there was more to come.
An example. Wes would wander into the day centre sometimes if he'd been working here at the woodyard, and he'd chat to our learning disabled chaps there. He'd sit and listen to them and make them laugh, appear to be giving them all his attention. I thought it was kind. Then I saw he only came in the afternoon, and on the days when they were baking. He came for the tea and cake. It was that simple.
Maybe he came for both.
Matthew wondered how such a small act of selfishness could have got under his usually tolerant husband's skin. Had Wesley provoked such a response in everyone who'd known him?
Yeah, perhaps. I'm just being cynical.
Matthew knew that was unlikely. Jonathan thought the best of everyone. The insight was useful.
I'll be late back, Matthew said.
Jonathan turned and saw Eve in Jen's car.
What's Evie doing here?
She found Wesley's body.
Oh no, Jonathan said. Not again. Not after finding her father. Can I take her back to our house? Really, she can't go back to Westercom on her own tonight.
Of course not.
Now Matthew was impatient.
I explained, she's a witness, a possible suspect.
It's a strange sort of job you have. Eve wouldn't hurt anyone.
There was a moment of silence.
When this is all over, Matthew said, we'll have her to stay then. You can work your magic, feed her up, bring her back to life. That's when she'll need a friend.
She needs a friend now. I'll go with her back to Westercombe and stay with her there until she's ready to be alone.
Matthew thought for a moment and nodded.
Jen can drive you both.
Chapter 19. All the way back to Westercombe, Eve remained silent and still. Jonathan sat next to her in the back of the car. He put his arms around her and pulled her in close to him. He was surprised by the warmth of her skin. He'd almost expected it to be as cold as ice, because she sat white and motionless as if she was frozen. He had a sudden picture in his head, as strange as a surrealist sculpture, of Eve thawing, of the grief flowing out, filling the car and drowning them both. They were driving against the flow of traffic, a stream of cars on their way back to Barnstable after a day on the beach, or a long, lazy afternoon in the bars and cafes. Jen made no effort to talk either. Jonathan thought she would become as fine a detective as Matthew one day. She understood emotional trauma and knew that victims had to be allowed their own time frame, their own healing process. Everyone was different. Jonathan had never previously been to Westercombe, and when they pulled into the farmyard, he was struck by the beauty of it all, distracted for a moment from his reason for being there. The low sun made the place glow, seem magical. Every colour was heightened, more intense. The red of the brick and tile at the big house, and the green of the field next to the lane where black and white cows grazed. From a distance, the thatched cottage could have been a poster for the North Devon Tourist Board. It was all too perfect and not quite real. It seemed flat to him, like a painting or a stage set. In this odd light, it had no depth. The car came to a stop, but Eve made no move to get out. Jen sat still too. "You ready?" she said at last. "No rush, though."
but she unclipped her seatbelt and made to step out of the car. "I'll go in with Eve," Jonathan said. "No need for you to come."
"I really should talk to her."
Jen's voice was kind enough, but she seemed prepared for battle.
"This is police business, nothing to do with you."
"Not yet," he said. "You must have got all you needed from Eve at the woodyard, for now at least." He saw she was about to argue again. "An hour," he went on. "Surely you can give her that to come round, to come to terms with what's happened." Jen seemed to think about it, and Jonathan wasn't sure what he'd do if she didn't agree. Matthew would be furious if he upset one of his core team of detectives. But finally, she nodded.
"Okay."
Jonathan leaned over and undid Eve's seatbelt, then helped her out of the car.
"Come on, my love," he said. "Let's get you home."
He still had his arm around her shoulders as she led him through the big kitchen and up the stairs to her flat. They sat together in the airy sitting room, with the window open and a breeze blowing the curtain. Eve still seemed numb. She allowed Jonathan to settle her on the sofa, a cushion at her back as if she were an invalid.
"What can I get for you?" he said. "Might you like a cup of tea?"
She smiled, and the muscles of her face seemed to be working for the first time since he'd arrived at the woodyard.
"I'd much rather have a glass of wine. There's a bottle in the fridge."
He fetched it, found a corkscrew in a drawer and glasses in a cupboard, and opened the bottle. He sat on the floor, a low coffee table holding the glasses between them.
"I was never sure how things were between you and Wesley," he said.
The words had come out without his thinking about them in advance.
"I was never sure either."
She gave another little smile and took a drink. Jonathan waited for her to speak again.
"I liked him," she said, "but not as much as he wanted. Wesley needed adoration, or at the very least a captive audience. I think that was why he couldn't settle to anything. He made interesting art, but he didn't believe in it unless somebody told him it was amazing. It was the same with his music. He was less interested in his work than in the reaction it created."
She looked up.
"I suppose he just wanted to be loved. And perhaps we're all like that."
"Did he love anyone?"
"Certainly not me, if that's what you're asking."
Her glass was empty. She stood up, went to the fridge in the corner, and filled it. She waved the bottle at Jonathan, but he shook his head.
"Maybe he was a bit in love with Janie," Eve said. "I saw the way he looked at her, and I'd never seen him like that before. He was always hanging round the sandpiper, and he kind of lit up when she was there."
"Did she reciprocate his affection?" Jonathan knew the Mackenzie family. Sometimes there were artistic links between the sandpiper and the woodyard. They had different audiences, and musicians coming to the region played both venues. He'd always dismissed Janie as hardly more than a schoolgirl, pretty but immature, a bit of a show-off. And he found it hard to imagine the pair as a couple.
"Oh, I don't think so. I'd have thought she was well out of his league."
Eve paused.
"I don't know her very well. She's not been back from university long. I always thought I should make more effort to become friends with her. Can't have been easy losing her brother and then being stuck working in the family business. But somehow the glass always seemed to get in the way."
Jonathan stood up and paced around the room. He didn't want to stay where he was, staring at Eve across the table. Even though he was sitting on the floor, it still felt like an interrogation. Besides, he was always restless and could never sit without moving for long. There was a big family photograph over the mantelpiece, and he settled in front of that. He recognized Nigel and Eve, and assumed that the attractive middle-aged woman smiling out at him was Helen, her mother. In the background, there was a line of dunes, the spikes of marram grass. He wondered where it had been taken.
"I slept with Wesley once."
Eve's words broke into his thoughts and pulled his attention away from the picture.
"I'd been dumped by a bloke I'd been going out with since university. I was lonely, wretched, and Wesley listened. At least he came here and helped me drink the very nice bottle of whiskey Dad had brought back for me from Islay. I thought he was listening, and we went to bed. But it didn't mean anything. Not really."
"A comfort shag," Jonathan said. She gave a little giggle. Perhaps she was already on the way to getting drunk.
"Something like that. Then I realised that crap telly and chocolate worked much better.
I regretted it in the morning and neither of us mentioned it again.
Wesley used to come into the Woodyard Cafe, Jonathan said. He was always with a woman, not the same woman each time, but the same type.
Older, a bit arty, and I bet they always paid for the meal.
Yeah. Jonathan realised then that he'd never seen Wesley at the counter with cash in his hand.
Sarah and I call them the groupies, his fans. He kindly allowed them to take him out and buy him dinner.
Who's Sarah?
Jonathan thought he was starting to sound like Matthew, asking questions. He should just let Eve talk.
Sarah Grieve. She lives in the cottage on the other side of the yard.
They sat in silence.
Jonathan realised then that Eve was crying, that tears were running down her cheeks. He stood up, fetched a roll of kitchen towel from the bench, tore off two pieces and handed them to her.
It was my glass that killed him, she said. Just like with Dad. Why would somebody do that? They had to go into Frank's part of the house and steal the vase and break it. Then they set me up to find him. Who would hate me that much?
I can't believe that anyone hates you.
Why use my glass then? Why try to point the blame at me?
Jonathan didn't have an answer to that. He sat beside her on the sofa and put his arms around her again, stroking her hair away from her face as if she were a child. Chapter 20. When Matthew drove into the farmyard, he saw Jen still sitting in her car, the windows open. By now it was evening, all long shadows and silence only broken by bird calls. He got out of his vehicle and walked towards her, then nodded up towards the attic.
How is she?
I don't know. I haven't talked to her yet. Jonathan asked for an hour with her before I started the questions.
Matthew felt a spark of fury. How dare Jonathan interfere with his investigation and order his staff around?
I was just about to go up. Jen seemed awkward, uncomfortable, a child caught in the middle of rowing parents. It wasn't fair, Matthew thought, to have to put her in this position, to have compromised her authority. Jonathan had used his relationship with Matthew to get his own way.
The hour was about up.
I'm sorry you were put in this situation, Matthew said. Eve's a witness, and you had better things to do with your time. Jonathan should have known that.
He was just being kind. She's been through a tough time. She needed the support.
With police officers. He knew his voice was sharp, hard. Not social workers.
What do you want me to do now?
Matthew thought for a moment.
Go home. It's not your fault you've been hanging around here with nothing to do. Show your face to the kids. I've called an early briefing in the morning. 7:30. Lots to discuss.
He paused.
In a while, I'm going to talk to Frank Lay. To see if the glass vase is still in his living room, or if Eve is right and it was used to stab our victim.
Matthew nodded. And to see what he's been doing with himself all day. I'd like to know what he made of Wesley Curnow too.
He stood until Jen had driven away, trying to calm himself. He was tempted to climb the narrow stairs into Eve's flat and tell Jonathan to go, but a public row wouldn't help now and would only embarrass her. That conversation would have to wait until later. He walked round the farmhouse and into the red light of the setting sun.
He saw Frank Lay through the living room window. From this angle, Matthew couldn't tell if the blue vase of flowers was still sitting on the hearth. Frank seemed to be working, to be going through the pile of papers that he'd placed on the arm of his chair. He was wearing little round spectacles, which made him look even more like Billy Bunter. At one point, the work seemed to overwhelm him. He took off his glasses and put his head in his hands. Matthew knocked at the door. Frank saw him and beckoned him in. The door was unlocked.
Inspector, do you have any news? Have you found out what happened to Nigel?
Matthew's eyes were drawn to the hearth. No flowers. No vase. He looked back at Lay.
I'm afraid I have other news. Another tragedy involving Westercombe Farm. Wesley Curnow is dead.
How did he die? Accident? Suicide?
The words were explosive, the tone so out of character that Matthew was shocked. Matthew didn't answer. He kept his voice even, conversational, He knew some of his team considered him dull, but sometimes he used lack of drama as a tactic, a weapon even. He'd never found that shouting produced results. Was Wesley the type of man who might commit suicide?
I'd never thought of him that way, but when you mentioned his death, I wondered if the two events might be related.
He thought Wesley might have killed himself because he'd murdered Nigel. Matthew thought that was a strange conclusion to jump to. A fit of regret, conscience. Do you think Mr. Curnow was capable of murder?
I think most of us would be capable of murder, Inspector.
Would I? Perhaps when I lose my temper, when my reason drowns in the stark white light, when my control shatters into pieces like Eve's hand-blown glass.
We don't think Wesley killed himself, Matthew said. We believe that he was murdered too.
Frank looked away.
What's going on here?
His voice was low, almost mumbling.
This is like some second-rate horror film.
He wasn't killed here. He was stabbed in the woodyard centre, in the place where he stored the materials for his work.
Matthew paused. Eve found him there.
Oh, no.
He stared back at Matthew in apparent disbelief.
Not Eve again. How is she?
Very shaken, of course. A friend is with her. Until now, Matthew had been standing, but he took a seat on the sofa. We have to inform Wesley's next of kin. I wonder if you know who that might be and how we might get hold of them.
I do.
The man seemed glad of the chance to help.
Their names are Martin and Liz. Martin was a financial journalist and I knew him through my work. I'll get their phone number. They moved to France when they retired to live the good life in the Dordogne.
Francis fumbled for his phone, his hands trembling, and passed it to Matthew so he could make a note of the numbers. Is that how Wesley came to be living here? Because you were a friend of his parents?
The family were from Cornwall. That gave Martin, Wesley's father, and me something in common when I was in London. We worked in different fields, of course, but we were both West Country boys, both interested in the politics of money. Wesley was always happier staying with his Cornish grandmother than in the city, and spent all his holidays there. He ended up at school in Truro.
Frank paused.
He tried all sorts when he left, but he couldn't settle. He dropped out of art school, ran a bar in Newquay for a couple of seasons, but couldn't make it pay, joined a band for a summer. All the time his parents were subsidising him, not really doing him any favours. By then he was in his 30s, almost middle-aged, and had never really earned his own living. In the end they decided to cut him loose.
And you took pity on him.
Matthew wondered if that was down to guilt again. To Lay's sense that his comfortable living had been achieved through luck and at the expense of other people.
I didn't want him out on the streets, Frank said. He paid rent, just like Eve. He made some beautiful objects. He really seemed settled, happy.
He paused.
I'd like to believe that I'd helped in that a little.
Did he know Nigel Yeo?
Only through Eve, I think.
Frank considered for a moment.
After Helen, Nigel's wife, died, I'd invite Nigel to dinner along with the others. Wesley certainly met Nigel here.
You asked Lauren Miller along once, too. She went on to become Nigel's colleague.
I did. A lovely woman.
He paused.
I had hoped we might get to know each other better.
His voice tailed off.
But in the end, I was too shy to ask to see her on her own. Besides, I'm sure I wasn't her type. She might have gone out with me through pity, but I could tell there was no real attraction, not on her part.
Matthew didn't say anything. It seemed Nigel and Lauren hadn't mentioned their relationship to Frank. At this point, he couldn't see any need to do it.
I understand that Wesley was friendly with the Mackenzies, he said. I presume he knew that Nigel was investigating the son's death. The family would have discussed it with him.
The family, perhaps, but not Nigel. He wouldn't have gossiped. He was always very discreet. He never told me what he'd discovered about the circumstances surrounding Mac's death, and I doubt if he told George and Martha either. The complaint might have come from them, but Nigel said from the start that any findings would be in a report to the Health Trust.
It wouldn't be made public. Matthew thought that was interesting.
Oh, I think it would, but the trust would be given the opportunity to respond first.
Do you know if the report had been completed?
No, you'd need to ask Nigel's colleagues in NDPT. Of course, Lauren might know.
Frank paused.
I don't see that there was any way Wesley could have learned about Nigel's findings.
He turned to the window and stared into the garden.
Besides, Wesley was always self-centered. I'm not sure he'd have cared much about it, unless it related to him.
It was getting late. The colour had seeped out of the sky. Frank hadn't switched on any lights and the room was shadowy. I have to ask this. What were your movements this afternoon? It was too dark now for Matthew to see clearly the expression on the other man's face.
I was here, working, mostly in my office in the house. I sat outside for a while this afternoon, but I didn't go anywhere else. You had an officer on the gate, I think. He'd be able to see my drive where it joins the lane. You'd be able to check.
Matthew nodded. He thought there was probably a way from the bottom of the garden to Instow, but he couldn't imagine Frank scrabbling through bramble and gorse to get there. He stood up. When I came yesterday, there was a vase of flowers on the hearth. It was large, round, more like a bowl than a conventional vase. I think Eve had made it. What happened to it?
Leigh looked at the space, as if noticing the absence for the first time.
Sarah must have come in earlier to do a quick tidy. I imagine the flowers were dying, so she threw them out and put the vase away.
It seemed odd to Matthew that the man wasn't more curious about his reason for asking the question, but he said nothing and let himself out. Matthew stood for a moment in the farmyard. There was a police van parked and a light on in Wesley's flat, so he assumed the search team were already in and working. There was still no sign of Jonathan. Again, he was tempted to go into Eve's flat to see what was happening there, but his anger had dispersed a little, and he hated the idea of making a scene. Joe Oldham, his boss, had left him a voicemail, saying they could push the budget a bit on this one.
The PCC is under pressure to get it sorted quickly. They don't want tourists cancelling because they think we've got a serial killer on the loose. The press has already got wind of the second murder.
Classic Oldham, shifting responsibility to the officers below him. Piling on the pressure, taking no real action to respond to the situation beyond giving him a little extra money. Oldham was close to retirement, ineffective, and all he wanted was a final year without confrontation or controversy. Matthew couldn't really blame him. He thought it would be churlish to drive home, leaving Jonathan here to get a taxi, and was about to text his husband to offer a lift when his attention was caught by a view inside the Greaves' cottage. The curtains hadn't been shut. And through the window he saw the couple inside, framed. They were sitting at the kitchen table, coffee mugs in front of them. He tapped at the window, surprising them. Sarah waved for him to come in.
I'm sorry if I made you jump. I should have thought.
Matthew introduced himself.
We spoke to your sergeant earlier.
I know, but that was before your neighbour had been killed.
Of course.
She paused for a moment.
I can't believe that Wes won't just wander in, saying the whole thing was some kind of tasteless joke, and trying to con a drink from us. The whole thing is a nightmare, so scary.
Sarah had got to her feet and automatically switched on the kettle.
We've been trying to work out what to do for the best, wondering if I should take the girls and stay with my mother for a bit. They've got school and everything we have is invested in this business.
Matthew could see that she was exhausted.
Just one question. Did you go in to clean for Frank today?
Good God, no. I haven't had a moment. Things have been bonkers for the last 2 days, and we've just been trying to catch up, do the essential stuff.
She looked up.
Why? Did he say he needed me to go in?
He told me you'd been in to do a quick tidy. She shook her head.
He must be mistaken. I dropped off a tub of cream in his fridge. He's a bit of an addict. But that was all. Is it important?
Matthew shook his head. Probably not. We're just trying to work out where everyone was. Did either of you leave the farm?
I went into Barnstable to do a supermarket shop, Sarah said. I took the girls and we went to the park first. They've got all this space to play in, but they do love it, and I just wanted to be away for a bit. You do understand?
Of course.
Mr. Grieve, where were you today? The man looked up.
Here, he said. Working. There's all this drama, but the place doesn't look after itself.
Matthew nodded. He wished he could speak to the man on his own. Grieve carried about him a sense of resentment, and if the rest of the family were in Barnstable all afternoon, perhaps he could have slipped away. He'd know the land, might have access to a vehicle away from the farm, but now wasn't the time for that conversation. Matthew was tired, and he felt his concentration wandering. He wasn't in the right mood to listen, and often, he thought, his work was all about careful, intense listening. Back in the farmyard, Jonathan was waiting for him, leaning against the car. His hair looked very white in the dusk. It glowed like a halo. Is Eve okay? Jonathan shrugged. As well as she could be in the circumstances. Halfway through a bottle of Pinot, there's no other booze in the place, I checked. The last thing she needs is to wake up with a hangover. You should have left Jen Rafferty to do the interview. It wasn't your place to interfere. Matthew unlocked the car and got inside. Jonathan followed. I wasn't interfering, I was being a friend. He paused. I'd have left as soon as Jen came up, but I wanted to make Eve comfortable. She was so stressed, rigid with shock. Matthew started the engine. He said nothing and let the tension stretch.
You don't think she killed those two men?
Jonathan demanded at last.
Her father and her friend. You don't think she took a piece of glass that she'd created and smashed it and stuck it in their necks and watched the blood flow out?
No, Matthew said. Of course not. Then what possible harm could I do? Matthew was about to talk about the importance of rules, procedure, but he could see that the words would mean nothing to Jonathan. Rules had never mattered to him. So instead, they drove back to the coast in silence.